Armand, a production of the California Society of CPAs and Cal CPA Institute. I'm Bill Spaniel. The most available statistics indicate that almost 122 million Americans are married, while about 18 million Americans are cohabitating, that is, living together without benefit of marriage. Just like married couples, unmarried, cohabitating couples have to figure out how they are going to handle their expenses. Who pays the grocery bills, especially if one partner wants caviar, but the other one can't stand the eggs? Should they buy a house together? Because an unmarried couple doesn't have a marriage contract, things can get a bit dicey when it comes to making monetary decisions. So we asked Janet Crockman, a Costa Mesa CPA, to provide some financial guidance for cohabitors. Hello, Janet. Welcome to Financial Empowerment.
Thanks, Bill. I'm happy to be here.
The focus of our program today is unmarried couples who live together. The old saying is that two can live as cheaply as one. Does that hold up for unmarried couples who live together?
Well, I think it does to the extent that it does when you have two people living together that are married. I don't actually think two people can live as cheaply as one, but there certainly is the opportunity to share expenses and sort of cut down on your overall cost and enhance your life. But I don't think you can quite use that adage entirely in today's economy as far as two for one.
Well, before a couple lives together, should they have a serious talk about their financial situation?
They should have at least one talk, if not multiple, because this is a very touchy subject, as you can imagine, and some individuals are much more comfortable in discussing it than others, and the time to find out just exactly where people's financial comfort zone is would be at the beginning of the relationship, not 6 months in.
Should they draft a budget?
I would recommend as much communication and putting things on paper as possible, simply because if things are assumed and not spoken or not documented, you know what they say about assumptions. And people's expectations with respect to the other party and their own sort of cultural bent with respect to how finances should be handled, all of those things are kind of up in the ether unless you actually sit down and have a conversation about them or put them to paper. And it's amazing how you would normally assume that because you're enjoying a relationship together that your financial aspects would be aligned, and 9 times out of 10, they're not.
How do you think an unmarried couple should divide expenses? Who should pay for what?
Well, that's, you know, getting down into the weeds, and that's obviously where the rubber meets the road. A lot of people would like to think that you're sharing in the electricity, the water, the gas, the trash, the cable equally, so you should pay for it equally. However, when you have various levels of income, you know, much like our tax system can be very regressive in some fashion, dividing things evenly across the board when you have quite a distance in income can also be very regressive for the person who earns the lower level of income. They pay a higher percentage of their income for the rent, the cable, and so forth. And so in the overall scheme of things, that might not actually be the fairest approach to the circumstance.
So would you say that the partner who has a larger income should pay a higher percentage of that income toward utility bills and other shared costs than the partner with the lower income?
This is really where the discussion, like I said, the rubber meets the road here, because if the other party is making twice as much as the first party, does it make sense to do it 50-50? And if it doesn't make sense to do it 50-50, well, then where do you move from there? Do you do it in relationship to the differences in income to the total income? If you're working from home, do you pay more of the electricity bill because you're running your computer all day long, or if you're a big gamer and you're on TV all night paying, you know, or on cable, internet doing video games all night, do you pay a higher percentage of the electric bill? I mean, there's different ways to divide it up other than just based on income. But I think the more you get into the conversation about utilization of the service, you can find that maybe some things should be 50-50 and other things shouldn't. And it's fine to have different methods of allocating the cost amongst the parties.
What are your thoughts about commingling funds? Should a couple have a joint checking account, for example?
I tend to like that idea simply because it allows for sort of a neutral place for each party to deposit their required contribution, for lack of a better word. However, it then is another checkbook to manage. And so someone has to take responsibility for managing the checkbook to make sure that there's, you know, the money goes in before the bill payments go out. Do you electronically pay the bills from that account? Do you write a check? Who's got to get the checks out into the mail? There's four or five steps in paying a bill if you do it manually, and if any of those don't happen, the bill doesn't get paid. And then if there's a late charge, who pays the late charge? Just creating the joint checking account, while it sounds like an easy way to sort of handle these things, it does add an extra layer of administrative oversight that somebody has to step up and take responsibility for.
When a couple decides to cohabitate, or get married for that matter, one partner is likely to bring along some kind of debt, such as major credit card bills or student loan debt. Should the other partner assist in paying off that debt?
In general, I would say no.
Mm-hmm.
The person with the debt made those decisions by themselves, came into the relationship with that debt. I think it needs to be part of that individual's plan to pay off that debt without assistance from the other party. Because again, whether they stay together or not, now you sort of are commingling, right? And again, I tend to be more on the camp of less commingling rather than more, simply because, and again, whether they're married or not, marriages statistically have a 50% or so divorce rate, and non-marriages have an either even greater breakup rate. So the chances of you finding yourself in a situation where you might not stay together is at least as almost as much as the fact that you're going to stay together. And the less commingling of things you have when that breakup occurs, the less entangled you're going to be in trying to divide things up.
And that leads me to another question I have. Do you think it is advisable for an unmarried couple to buy a house together and share in the mortgage?
Well, that is a big step. However, you know, joint tenancy has been a legal status for generations and still continues to be to this day. We see it a lot in business applications, and that's really, to some extent, what you have when you have an unmarried couple purchase a house. It's two individuals. They have an undivided interest in 50% of the property. They should both be on the mortgage, and they should both make their respective, you know, share of the mortgage. And unfortunately, much as in a married couple situation, when the relationship terminates, you now have a joint owned asset. Is one person going to buy the other person out, or are you simply going to sell? And of course, it takes the two people that are on the deed and on the note to agree to that sale. And the proceeds can be split through escrow. That is how it should be handled.
What if the couple has children? How should child rearing costs be handled?
That adds a whole other layer to the cake, so to speak. I would certainly think that if both parents were part of the decision to have the children, mm-hmm. that both parents should equally share in the child rearing, because now you've got another person involved. I think it would be difficult to make an arrangement such that you did not have an equal contribution. Now, having said that, if the decision is made by the couple that one person is the stay-at-home caretaker parent and the other person is the breadwinner parent, there needs to be an equation, if you will, even though it's obviously a non-monetary calculation, but there still needs to be a determination of the value of that caregiving in the overall equation, because that doesn't happen for free. So I think that would help go a long way toward sort of balancing the scale, as it were.
Are there any tax benefits to living together?
There sure are. Unfortunately, because our tax system is progressive as it is, mm-hmm. when you have a married couple as one taxpayer, that taxpayer is taxed on the sum of the two incomes. And the higher you go on the pay scale, so to speak, or the income scale, the higher percentage of tax you pay, both federal and state, local, city, all of those things that tax the higher levels at higher percentages hit married couples. Individuals that are not married, they still have the same household income, but it's taxed as two separate taxpayers, lower amounts on each return, therefore lower rates.
With all the complications of living together and figuring out who pays for what, do you think it is wise for a couple to draw up a contract regarding each other's financial obligations before moving in together?
Well, I think that's going to be an individual decision. Certainly, if there are large sums of money involved, I would think that a contract or a memorandum of understanding or something of that nature could be beneficial. In areas where large sums of money are not involved, mm-hmm. still an agreement between the parties I don't think is ever a bad thing, because again, relationships are complicated enough without bringing in the finances. So if they can't really sit down and articulate and agree amongst themselves to even putting something in writing at the beginning of the relationship, it's not going to get any better as time goes on. It usually only gets worse. So there really needs to be a meeting of the minds at the beginning, and if there is a meeting of the minds, they should be able to put that on paper. And mm-hmm. and they sign it. Maybe they even witness it. I don't think you'd have to go to the point of notarization, but just have, you know, a roommate or a friend or something else witness it so it does have some legal standing. Not that they're probably ever going to take it to court, but again, in the event of a dispute, it's a document that says, at the time that we entered into this relationship, these were the rules that we decided to operate under, and okay, if things have changed, fine, but up to that point, these should have been the rules.
So that kind of document would be helpful if the couple eventually decides to split.
Exactly. And even, you know, if somebody decides one day to go off and buy, I don't know, a fancy car or a drone or some toy, right? Or some mm-hmm. extravagant expenditure that is outside the norm, if it has an impact on the other individual, it probably or should have been covered in that agreement. Again, you know, you don't necessarily always want to have the ability to point fingers, but if there is a disagreement, there needs to be a solution. Having sort of a governing document can help make that process smoother.
Do you have clients who are cohabitating? And if so, how frequently do you talk to them about this subject?
I do have quite a few, and we don't really discuss it too much because one of the interesting things about people that cohabitate, and this is going to sound a little strange, I think, but I do believe that there's a parallel. They actually run the financial aspect of their relationships more like a business mm-hmm. than probably a married couple does. You know, marriage, especially in California with the community property rules, tends to lead people to aggregate almost everything. I mean, they only have one checking account, and both of their names are on the checking accounts and the credit cards, and they commingle everything because that's what married people do, right? But people that aren't married, that aren't bound by those community property rules and so forth, tend to keep their finances mostly separate. And then because there isn't any of this commingling, I don't have to worry about you spending money on what you want because it's not my money. And conversely, you don't really have any interest or say in what I do because it's my money. And as long as we cover the joint bills that we've agreed to and we're keeping those all up to date and everything else, life goes on quite happily.
Thank you, Janice, for talking to us about cohabitation. Do you have anything else to add?
Moving from a cohabitation to a married couple situation, depending on how long people have cohabitated and so forth, I still think a discussion under the new set of rules, right, the community property and all of that, would still be something beneficial for couples to have.
We thank Jenna Crockman for guiding us through some of the financial decisions cohabitating couples have to make. We appreciate your listening to CalCPA's Financial Empowerment Program, which was produced in April 2018. If you would like to comment about our show, have a question for a CPA, or would like to suggest topics for future programs, write us at financialempowerment@calcpa.org or simply visit www.calcpa.org. You can search there for a California CPA who can help you save on taxes, better manage your investments, or budget for those rainy days even sunny California sometimes has. Just click on the Find a CPA link. This is Bill Spaniel, and you've been listening to Edition 207 of Financial Empowerment, a production of the California Society of CPAs and Cal CPA Institute.